From NPR, this is Justice Talking. I'm Margot Adler. As drought conditions become long-term in hot spots around the country, America's water wars are heating up, too.
We will respect the resources that we share with our neighbors. But hear me now. We will not allow others outside this state to hamper our progress by limiting our access to the waters that fall on our land.
I'm increasingly inclined to believe that what is going on is we're about to embark on three more years of doing nothing about water allocation.
Water is becoming an ever more precious resource around the country. Is there a fair way to share it? Coming up after the news. This is Justice Talking from the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg Public Policy Center. I'm Margot Adler. Vast regions of the United States are drying out. Droughts are more severe and lasting longer. But policymakers and climatologists say smart water policies could steer us away from environmental calamity and resolve water wars across the country. On today's Justice Talking, the gift of water and how to share it in a time of growing scarcity. Scientists say they are still trying to understand the full dimensions of changing weather patterns in the U.S. In the Southwest, climatologists are trying to gauge the scale of a decade-long drought. And in the Southeast, they are still trying to understand exactly what climate forces are causing the worst drought there in 100 years. The water scarcity is exacerbating a 10-year-old fight among Florida, Georgia, and Alabama over water in the Chattahoochee River. It's a small river, but three states claim they depend on it. From Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta, Susan Capelluto reports.
It's a sunny day at Atlanta's Piedmont Park, and Bruce and Kathy Bernstein are walking their dogs. This year, they say the bright colors are missing in the park.
They haven't put up pansies because of the drought, which is a good thing. You know, they haven't planted those.
Or you'll see little signs that they're not planting because of the drought.
The Bernsteins say they do all they can to conserve water. They've stopped washing their car, and they say they're glad they live in a condo where they don't need to care for a lawn. Since the summer, all outdoor watering has been banned in North Georgia. Here at Piedmont Park, the drought has stressed the grass so much that the city canceled several popular festivals. Atlanta gets its water from a reservoir called Lake Lanier. It's about 20 feet below normal, and winter rains have only added a few inches so far. If things get worse, Atlanta's drinking water might even be affected. Officials say lower levels could mean extra treatment to keep the tap water safe for drinking. That worries Mary Drury, who's visiting the park with her 2-year-old son, Noah.
I guess with little children, you think too, just drinking water and the health of the water. I hear that, you know, it's the lower it gets, the worse the water is.
Lake Lanier sits on top of the Chattahoochee River, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers uses the lake to control the flow of the river, according to a plan from 1958. The Corps must balance the needs of Metro Atlanta with the needs of downstream users. Alabama wants water for critical power plants, and Florida has endangered species and an oyster industry that depend on the flow of the Chattahoochee. But Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue says they want too much of Lake Lanier. In his State of the State address last month, Perdue said he'll fight to keep more water in Georgia.
We will respect the resources that we share with our neighbors. But hear me now. We will not allow others outside this state to hamper our progress by limiting our access to the waters that fall on our land.
With all eyes on the drought, the three states have been involved in an intensifying dispute over who gets how much of Lake Lanier. There have been talks between them over the years with no consensus over how to divide the shrinking supply of water. New talks are scheduled for later this month, and this time Georgia lawmakers can show that they have passed a statewide water plan. 3 years in the making. It will take another 3 years to fully implement. Critics say they expect few results because there's very little state funding attached to the new water plan. Neil Herring is a lobbyist with the Sierra Club. He says it's hard to call it a plan at all. He calls it a stall tactic.
I'm increasingly inclined to believe that what is going on is we're about to embark on 3 more years of doing nothing about water allocation in the state so that Metro Atlanta can continue to grow the way it's grown the last 3 years of supposed water planning.
But others are backing the governor. Sam Williams, president of the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce, says what's good for Atlanta is good for Georgia.
Well, I think there's an analogy that may apply here. Some people say all of the Middle East wars are about oil. The water wars are about jobs. They're not about conservation. They're not about environmental protection or endangered species. There are efforts by neighboring states to restrict the growth and economic success of Georgia, hoping that those jobs would go elsewhere. That's what it's about.
Competition for industry investment is fierce among the 3 states, but environmentalists argue it's not just jobs at stake, and they say Metro Atlanta's unbridled growth needs to stop. Florida and Alabama are putting up a united front to get their share of water, and all 3 states haven't been shy about using the courts to fight for their positions. Meanwhile, the Corps of Engineers decided last month to start rewriting the 50-year-old plan it uses to manage Lake Lanier. For Justice Talking, I'm Susanna Capoluto in Atlanta.
That dispute in the Southeast may be more entrenched than ever. Florida recently lost a battle in federal court to hold on to more of the water in Lake Lanier. Experts say the ruling is sure to slow the pace of water-sharing talks between the 3 states. Here to talk about the intertwining forces shrinking our water resources and what it will mean is Roger Pulwardy. He is a climatologist and director of the National Integrated Drought Information System, which is a coordinated effort by government and research groups to monitor drought throughout the country. Roger, what's going on? Are we running out of fresh water?
There's been an extended drought, probably the worst in some parts in 100 years. But what does a drought mean in that context? It means that we have probably the reliability of our water supply for meeting our needs, environmental, societal, and impacts, are at risk. Mm-hmm. So in the Southeast, what we're facing right now is a little bit of increasing conflict between Alabama and Georgia, which might not have occurred before simply because what we're seeing is an extended drought coupled with increasing population demand and use. And so those combine to create a situation in which we have conflict over resources.
What do you see as the forces that are behind all this? Why are we running out of fresh water?
Well, in certain places we are. I wouldn't say that in total we're sort of running out of fresh water. I think what's actually happening is that we're seeing some, you know, indications towards extended drought occurring in the Southwest. But we've had 10-year droughts in the Southwest before. This one's warmer than, let's say, the droughts of the 1950s, so that increases evaporation and it increases the reliability of supply and also increases the loss that we see in snowpack. Now, coupled with that is the obvious, the growth that we have in terms of the use of those resources, Colorado, Utah, Arizona, Nevada, four of the fastest growing states in the country. Along with that comes increasing demand, but there are ways to manage demand as well.
What's the role of global warming in all this?
I'll give you an example. In 2005, we had about 105% of snowpack on the Colorado Plateau, but that resulted in about 75% of runoff because the January to July was so warm, we lost that, a lot of that to evaporation, to dry soils, things like that. So you do have a global, let's say, a warming signal in there, but on top of the warming is, let's say, in the Southeast. If you add La Nina, which has a dry impact in the Southeast, and you put global warming on top of that, you have a surprise in the system. We don't actually know which way that would go. It could exacerbate the drought situations. It could prolong them. And on top of that, we have demand.
Do these water wars that we're seeing in the South and in the Southwest, is there a kind of ripple effect from them? I mean, do you see that there's going to be a problem of moving water from the Great Lakes to the Southwest? Are we going to see this in a sort of national context?
I think at the national level, what we're beginning to look at is what sort of information can we provide up front about the likely severity, duration of drought, and then what sort of efficiency mechanisms can we put into place, behavioral and institutional, so that not only do we have water, let's say, for those that need it, but also heading off conflicts.
If ultimately we're facing a future where there will be less fresh water, will we be thinking about our water footprints, you know, in the same way that we've begun to think about our carbon footprint?
I think we do already look at how we allocate, and we have water meters in some places. We don't have a good enough handle yet on how much water we use in terms of being able to get as concrete about a footprint as you're suggesting. I think it is the direction that we will end up going in order not only to say, okay, let's make some rules about who can and can't use how much, but that people know the cost of the water that they're using. That's really the important thing here. Not only the cost in terms of the economics, but how much water we use and what is lost from the environment when we use it.
Let's say nothing was done around this issue at all. What's the worst-case scenario?
Actually, no, that's a good question. The drought in the Southeast is not, we haven't tied that to, let's say, climate change and global warming. In the Southwest, it's an interesting question because there are basically four things that produce a crisis situation in the Southwest. A severe sustained drought, which we're some people think we're in the middle of exactly that. I don't know if we're in the middle or we're just starting it. Another would be an energy crisis, the demands that water places on energy. Third would be the transfer of water from other basins. And a fourth aspect is the unquantified rights of water. So what would be happening? Would we be seeing migration out of those areas as a result of the increasing cost of water? There has been the suggestion that folks would be moving back into the Midwest near the Great Lakes, the great 20% of the world's fresh water is in the Great Lakes, 95% of the U.S. supply of fresh water. So the question is, would we be moving to places of water? Well, it depends on the price, whether or not it begins to cost us less just to move water to us or for us to move to the water.
How do you raise public awareness around water? It certainly took decades for the public to respond to global warming.
Well, the thing about it is, you know, there's Mark Twain, you know, possibly apocryphal, saying that, you know, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over. That's a long time ago that we realized that. John Wesley Powell in the late 1800s said that, you know, we will be approaching the time of crisis soon. That's over 100 years ago. So there have been people out there saying, okay, let's be careful about how we're using water. What we haven't been very good at is communicating what is lost by not having more efficient use of water in terms of cultural attributes, farms, tribal lands, ranching. Do we want to see that change? And more than anything, the role of water in ecosystem function and support.
Roger Pulwardy is a climatologist and director of the National Integrated Drought Information System. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Most certainly. Thank you.
Nowhere are the potential risks and losses more evident than in the water wars of the Southwest. Coming up, a Las Vegas water manager says her community understands the stakes.
We're not stupid. I mean, we fully realize that if you destroy an ecosystem and if you destroy the valley, you're going to destroy your water supply at the same time.
But conservationists say it's time for fundamental change.
The question was whether or not we ought to do a better job of addressing explicitly the question of growth, rather than making our water managers meet whatever growth occurs.
And ranchers and farmers have their own views on what's fair and what isn't when it comes to water policy. Stay with us. This is Justice Talking, the public radio show about law, justice, and American life. I'm Margo Adler. On today's Justice Talking, we are exploring how water shortages are changing landscapes and policies. In places where dry weather is threatening water sources, lake levels are lower and some of the nation's great river systems are shrinking. The Colorado River is one of them. It supports the water needs of 7 different western states and 25 million people. Its diminishing volume has spurred numerous regional disputes and led some to call for systemic change in how we manage water. Las Vegas is center stage in these disputes. Here to explore how policymakers can and should respond to a drier world are Pat Mulray and Peter Glick. Mulray heads up the Southern Nevada Water Authority, a regional agency responsible for acquiring, treating, and delivering water for Southern Nevada, including Las Vegas. Mulray has been called one of the most outspoken and influential water managers in the country. And Peter Glick is the president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute, a research group dedicated to water sustainability and conservation. Welcome to Justice Talking.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Las Vegas is really up against it. It has a growing population and one of the driest places in the U.S. Pat, you are working hard to boost supplies of water to the region. Some of your projects are controversial, and we'll talk about that. But first, let's talk about some of the aggressive conservation policies Las Vegas has adopted. The city has rid itself of 80 million square feet of water-loving lawns. Job-generating destination hotels like the Bellagio have sophisticated water recycling systems. Those fancy fountains use recycled water. Sounds like a good-faith effort at conservation. So, Peter, tell me, how much more could Las Vegas be doing?
Well, let me make a couple of points here. First of all, the question is not whether we can conserve our way out of our water problems. Conservation and efficiency is one tool of many in what will be a sustainable water future. I don't believe, however, that Las Vegas has been nearly as aggressive in conservation and efficiency as perhaps you describe, and certainly as I think they could be. They've been aggressive on reducing area of lawn, although not as aggressive as Tucson or not as effective as Tucson, for example. And they've done very little on indoor. That could be much more could be done to reduce inefficient indoor uses to help fuel the growth that they see coming. And we did a report at the Pacific Institute about this, and we looked at the potential. And it's cheaper and it's faster than building a big pipeline at this point. But I'm not saying they may not need a pipeline in the future. I just think you could do a lot more now to reduce the need for new supply.
Pat, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I actually do. You know, the whole reason for the in-state project has absolutely nothing to do with growth. We have a community now of 2 million people that relies 90% on the Colorado River for its water supply. We stand the very real possibility of losing our upper intake by 2010. At that point, Hoover Dam stops generating electricity. There was a story in both the local and the regional newspapers recently that spoke to the stress that the Colorado River Basin is going to be in for global warming. There is no way any water manager in the West can solely rely on a single source of water anymore. And when you have a 90% reliance on the Colorado River, you can't conserve your way out of it. And the problem is, if we're sitting right now with less than 50% storage in the two reservoirs, one water year like 2002, where we had 25% inflow, will crater us. And you can have all the arrangements with other states that you want on the Colorado. If that lake is empty, all bets are off and everything starts changing.
Let me just follow up a little bit with you, Pat, before turning to Peter. I know that you are pushing through very aggressively in the region to reroute water, and you have this big pipeline project. And I've seen a lot of articles that have said that there are real problems as far as opposition from ranchers and farmers who are extremely frightened and say that the aquifers essentially keep their farms alive, and they're very frightened about the future if this pipeline comes to pass.
This issue plays itself out on all sorts of levels. Plays itself out on rural versus urban, agriculture versus municipal, northern Nevada versus southern Nevada. There are all kinds of emotional buttons that get pushed with this project. In going into these basins, Nevada has one of the strictest groundwater laws anywhere in the country. You can only move perennial yield or that which annually is replenished in the basin. We've also bought significant surface water supplies that we intend to recharge the basin with. And it is going to take that kind of an aggressive management strategy as we move into global warming. At the end of the day, I think what's going to happen is the farmers are going to be benefiting from the investments the cities are making in those areas to recharge those basins and manage those basins. So we're not stupid. I mean, we fully realize that if you destroy an ecosystem and if you destroy the valley, you're going to destroy your water supply at the same time. And any water manager worth his salt today knows that they have a huge custodial responsibility, stewardship responsibility, when it comes to preserving and protecting natural resources.
Peter?
Well, yes. I think without a doubt Las Vegas has one of the most difficult challenges in the West. And there's an enormous value to diversity of supply, and Las Vegas is very dependent on the Colorado River, which is very vulnerable to, first of all, overuse. We've given away more of the Colorado to humans than it looks like nature's going to reliably provide to us in the long run. And climate change may make that considerably worse. But then the question has to be, what are the relative costs of the different options that you have? There are political and environmental and social and economic costs to building a new pipeline up to rural Nevada to take water. There are very difficult political questions that are unresolved, and I can't comment on whether or not this pipeline will ever be built. That's a challenge for Nevada to wrestle with, for Utah, since they think some of this groundwater may belong to them. But I also think that you have to look at water management in a totally comprehensive way. And if we're building in a very expensive pipeline to supply inefficient uses in Las Vegas, then I would argue the first thing you want to do is make those uses as efficient as possible so that the size of the pipeline is small, is smaller, or you put it off for a couple of decades, or you find other ways to meet your needs. And I think that's a question that has not adequately been addressed in Nevada, in Las Vegas, and frankly, not completely adequately addressed in the Western U.S. as a whole.
Pat, do you think at some very basic bottom level there is an issue with growth in a desert?
Let's look at cities across this country. I mean, with some glaring exceptions like Chicago that sits on the Great Lakes, New York imports its water for New York City from upstate New York. San Francisco, where Peter lives, brings in a vast majority of its water supply from Hetch Hetchy, from Yosemite. The Metropolitan Water District of Southern California has two enormous water supply sources, the Colorado River and the Bay Delta in California. Every time you create a city, and it's pretty irrelevant of whether it's in a desert or whether it's New York City, there is never an adequate enough water supply in that particular area to service millions and millions of people.
The question is not whether Las Vegas ought to exist where it does. No one's disputing that. The question was whether or not we ought to do a better job of addressing explicitly the question of growth rather than making our water managers meet whatever growth occurs. And in the past, that's what we've done. The city grows and it grows, and there's encouragement to developers, there are tax breaks, because for some reason we like growth, in infinite growth. And the water managers have been left to deal with that. And I don't think that's going to work in the 21st century. It's time the water managers like Pat Mulroy had a say in the size and the details of the growth that's occurring, because it may not make sense to encourage growth everywhere the way we've encouraged it in the past.
I want to ask both of you about the struggle between urban and agricultural needs. 90% of Nevada's water goes to farmers. Traditionally, these water wars have played out in the press as a struggle between the farmers who say we need the water for crops and cities who say we need the water for our growing populations. How do we reconcile these two sides? I'll start with you, Peter.
Well, in fact, the growing question of where we allocate our water in the Western U.S. is going to be key to the sustainable management of that limited water resource in the coming years. And in the past, the vast majority of the infrastructure that was built and the vast majority of the allocations of water have been to irrigated agriculture in the West. And of course, we have a wonderful agricultural society in the United States. We produce a huge amount of food, but it takes a tremendous amount of water. And in recent years, we've seen a growing discussion about how to move some of that water out of agriculture while maintaining a healthy agricultural economy to the growing cities that can pay much more for water, that produce many more dollars per gallon, if you will. There have been increasing trades of water from agricultural users to urban users. I think we're going to see more of that. The days when it was fine to irrigate alfalfa in the desert, I think, maybe coming to an end.
Pat?
It's also very cultural. I agree with Peter. I don't think it'll completely come to an end. I think there is a certain amount of alfalfa, Sudan grass, that's going to be needed for our own dairy and for our own cattle. But we export a lot of it. And when you export your alfalfa and you export your Sudan grass, you're exporting your water. And I think that's where the stress is beginning to show. And when, this is going to sound harsh, when these very ranchers in northern Nevada or central Nevada and in Utah
are complaining about their livelihood being eroded, that's not necessarily true. I mean, they're not looking for those kind of partnerships. They don't want to change either.
The struggle over who gets diminishing and vital water resources seems to be an intensifying problem in all corners of the country, from Oregon to Florida. Even the 8 states that make up the Great Lakes District are expressing alarm and making territorial moves to protect what they see as a threatened resource. Peter, how do you see us moving forward? And is this a place where we need national leadership, a national water policy?
Well, interestingly, we don't have a national water policy, and that's an okay thing sometimes, and it's a bad thing sometimes. A lot of the water challenges that we face are very local, and a national water policy may not help us. But there are things we do at the national level that affect us locally and affect us internationally. And I think it's long past time that we had a discussion at the national level about what a sustainable water system would look like in the 21st century. In terms of moving forward, I think we need to really rethink the way we use water. And in the long run, climate change is coming. It's going to affect every aspect of our water resources. And we're just not managing our water in a way that's going to address that kind of a challenge either.
Pat, has your thinking about water changed in your years of dealing with water issues?
Absolutely. I don't think you can be in this business and not have a change. And I think probably the most profound change is when I took over this job, there are always winners and there were losers. I mean, that's the myth of the Old West. We have priority water rights, which are my personal pet peeve. I started in that era. And then the more I stayed in it, I said, wait a minute, there can't be winners and losers. There is nothing more fundamental to human existence at all levels, whether it's the environment that we enjoy, the food that we eat, or our very own sustenance, than a water supply. It doesn't belong on Wall Street. It doesn't belong commoditized. It is a very different resource.
Pat Mulroy is head of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. Peter Glick is the president of the Pacific Institute. Thank you both for coming on Justice Talking.
Thank you, Margo.
Thanks, Margo.
As calls go out for a more collaborative approach to water management in the United States, some agricultural groups say reformers often unfairly single out farmers and ranchers for criticism. Chris Shearing is a lawyer with the California Farm Bureau Federation. He represents family farmers and ranchers on issues including water, land use, endangered species, and air quality. Shearing says farmers understand all too well that water sources are drying up. He says some have turned away from corn and other vegetable crops that need a lot of water, but he says that's no panacea.
Some folks are making the decision to go to different types of crops, including trees and vines, because they can do that with less water. Now, that's a situation that it's got its own set of pitfalls, though, because once you've got trees in the ground, then you're really committed in terms of being able to apply that water or lose the crop permanently for year after year after year. So
I would imagine that also there are certain questions about efficiency and the way people farm that comes into this. Are there techniques to conserve water that aren't currently used that could make a difference in farming?
Well, efficiency is something that farmers have been working on for quite a while. I think overall, agriculture's use of water has remained relatively flat, but over time, agriculture has been producing much more with a given quantity of water. So that tells you that we're making gains in terms of irrigation efficiency. At the same time, I don't think that farmers becoming more efficient is the solution to the West water crisis. It just isn't. When we're, you know, we've got burgeoning cities in the desert, when we've got increased deployment of environmental statutes and requirements for in-stream flows, you know, clearly conservation is not going to save the day in the American West.
When you look at agricultural interests, do you see them as fundamentally opposed to urban interests, environmental interests, or do you see them as sort of in some way the same? How do you look at that?
Well, I hate to see any interest group opposed, because the only way we can move forward to a solution set is to work cooperatively. I think that you will find, at least in the area of water, farm interests opposed to urban interests, opposed to environmental interests, if we continue to have a situation of skyrocketing demand and a fixed or declining supply situation, which is what we've got.
And when you think about water shortages and the environmental changes that are going on, how do you see these as impacting America's food supply?
Well, and that's the other piece of it, quite frankly. What we do with water policy in the American West in the next 50 years is going to translate into a number of things. There's a food security question involved, which is that if we alter federal policy and state policy with respect to water to the detriment of agriculture, we're going to lose some of the agricultural production that we have here at home. That translates into a sort of a food security issue. Do we want to get more and more of our food from the third world? It seems to be contrary to what people are asking for these days, which is a more local production of food, you know, eat local, buy local, that sort of thing. Well, if we dry up the water supply to the farms, eating local is going to be real difficult.
Chris Shearing is a lawyer with the California Farm Bureau Federation. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Margo.
Farmers, conservationists, and city water managers are drawing attention to the water crisis they see on the horizon. But for some, the crisis is already here. Coming up, an expert on endangered species says the loss of water sources is a major killer.
It's a very widespread problem, and it's only going to get worse with all of the global warming models that are out there today.
And America's mayors are raising their own alarm. It's estimated that up to $500 billion will be needed for the nation's pipes and sewers.
Our infrastructure is aging. There has been no major new investment in water and sewer infrastructure in decades and decades.
Stay with us.
Justice Talking is produced by the Annenberg Public Policy Center, a think tank at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. The program is made possible with support from the Annenberg Foundation. The foundation works to advance public well-being through improved communication. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and West Legal Ed Center, where lawyers can listen to Justice Talking for MCLE credit online at westlegaledcenter.com. And from Oxford University Press, publisher of the United States Constitution, What It Says, What It Means, a Hip Pocket Guide. The Hip Pocket Constitution is available at justicetalking.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Justice Talking has entered the blogosphere. Each day, check out a new commentary from one of our contributors who cares passionately about law and justice issues. At justicetalking.org, you can also find forums where you can weigh in on the issues we cover on Justice Talking, like the environment, criminal justice, religious freedom, and elections. Continue the debate online with other Justice Talking listeners at justicetalking.org. This is Justice Talking, where we make the connection between law, justice, and American life. I'm Margo Adler. Today we're talking about America's water resources in a period of climate change. Heavily populated regions of the country are also getting drier, and one expert on endangered species says the threat to wildlife cannot be underestimated. Kieran Suckling is the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to Justice Talking.
Glad to be here.
Endangered species are at the heart of some of the most visible water wars in the country. Where are shrinking water sources threatening animals right now? Tell us about them.
Well, it's happening everywhere, unfortunately. Some of the most high-profile areas are the Klamath River in southern Oregon, where we've got endangered salmon and endangered Klamath suckers being endangered by water withdrawals. In the
Are suckers like leeches?
They are not, no. They're a bottom-dwelling fish that eats mostly vegetation, hence the sucking. Actually a handsome creature, but very imperiled. But that's just one of many. In the San Francisco Bay Delta, we are having a biological meltdown right now due to water diversions. And up there, there's a fish called the Delta smelt that is perilously close to extinction. There's the Sacramento splittail, another fish, and the salmon are also doing very poorly. Over in Georgia in the southeast, of course, we've got the whole issue now with the Apalachicola Basin, this big water war between Georgia and Florida and Alabama, which a whole series of endangered freshwater mussels are quite in the middle of. So it's a very widespread problem, and it's only going to get worse with all of the global warming models that are out there today.
And do you see this as a series of local problems, or are you seeing this as a problem of national proportions?
Oh, it's definitely a problem of national proportions. In fact, if you look at the problems over in Georgia of Lanier Lake, that has ended up going all the way to the Secretary of Interior coming in to try to moderate, because the economic issues at stake are enormous. The environmental issues are quite spectacular. We have a similar thing going on in the San Francisco Bay Delta, where if you look at the forces involved in these negotiations, it's everything from the Secretary of Interior to the governor. So they're very big, and then they're happening everywhere. I mean, I could talk to you about the desert pupfish in Nevada and species that have already gone extinct due to water withdrawals in the Everglades. It's a looming and ever-present crisis.
Let's focus on a couple of these examples. What's threatening the mussels and the Gulf sturgeon in Georgia?
They're threatened by water pollution, by dams which block their passage upstream, and then simply by low water levels, which take away the habitat they need to survive. And all three of those problems, dams, pollution, low water levels, come back ultimately to the amount of water in the river, and it's being diverted off for agricultural uses, for urban water uses, and there's just not enough there for these species to survive.
When I've read about this conflict in the press and I've heard characterizations by Georgia officials, I keep on hearing, you know, this is a battle, you know, of man versus mussel. And I'm going to make a wild assumption that you don't think that's a correct characterization.
You're quite correct. I mean, what's really going on here is that the mussels have been caught up in a water war between Florida and Georgia, Alabama to a lesser extent. And because every drop of water that Georgia keeps in its reservoirs and does not allow down the river is a drop of water that does not flow to Florida. And Florida wants that water badly for all of the same reasons: agriculture, urban development, also for cooling power plants. So those are the primary forces at loggerheads here. And in fact, if you look at this battle as it's been playing out of last decade, it's really been almost entirely Georgia and Florida suing each other. It is only recently that endangered species have come up. And even there, what you see is it's Florida suing Georgia over impacts to endangered species. And I don't want to make it sound like Florida is simply cynical in this matter. I do think that Florida does want to protect these mussels. They are endangered. Florida is also smart enough to realize that these mussels are protected by the Endangered Species Act. And there's a lot of mussel behind that law to keep the water flowing. But I view the mussel crisis going on there now as really they're just caught in the middle of this gunfight between these two very powerful states. And as much as I hate to see these issues ever get pitted as endangered species versus humans, I have to say I'm somewhat glad that people are talking about mussels at all, because the biggest extinction crisis we have in all of North America is southeastern mussels, and it's never talked about. So at least they're getting some media attention now, even if it's not entirely positive.
And I've read comparisons that have said that these mussels in Florida are like canaries in a coal mine. Can you explain that?
Yeah, these mussels live in the water 24 hours a day. The way they feed is to absorb that water through their bodies while they filter out the nutrients and back out the other side. So any pollution that is in this water completely envelops these species inside and out. And so there really is no better indicator of your water quality than your muscles. Mm-hmm. And secondly, they have these wonderful and very complex ecological interactions with other species. And so when you see the mussels start to decline, you can very quickly surmise that other species are declining as well. For example, mussels themselves don't swim, don't crawl very far. So they're in the river. They're constantly getting washed downstream. They have to find a way to get upstream, and it's not going to be under their own power. So what they do is they hang out these little lures for fish passing by, and the lure will actually mimic exactly the food that each particular species of fish wants to eat. The fish comes, grabs the lure, and then the mussel spreads its eggs onto the fish. Fish swims upstream and deposits the eggs. That's the cycle of reproduction for this species. Well, these dams all throughout the southeast have blocked the ability of these fish to move upstream. So when we see the mussels decline, part of what we're seeing is, oh, the fish have declined as well. They can no longer get upstream to do this kind of work. So mussels really are just to provide an excellent window onto the health of these entire systems, and we should be very, very concerned that they are doing so badly.
If you were going to make a list of what is threatening animal life, where would the loss of water rank?
It would be right at the very top, if you want to put it in that way. Usually people talk more generally about habitat loss. That's the number one threat to endangered species. About 86% of all species are threatened by the loss of their habitat. But if you then look and say, okay, what do we mean by habitat loss? What's that look like in more detail? The majority of these habitat loss situations involve water, because that is the limiting factor for all these species. And so if you were to, say, rank mining, logging, development, and then against water withdrawals, water depletion, drought, the water issues are going to trump them all in terms of affecting the most species. And unfortunately, what we're seeing with all of the global warming models is that these water problems are going to increase with global warming, especially in the western states.
Kieran Suckling is the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Arizona. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Glad to be here.
While many are watching and worrying over falling lake levels, low snow melt, and river systems in danger, there is another risk to water resources in America that few see. The nation's municipal waterworks are mostly old, and many say they are in need of critical repairs. Martin Chavez is mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico. He is also co-chair of the Mayor's Water Council for the United States Conference of Mayors. Welcome to Justice Talking.
Great to be with you.
The U.S. Conference of Mayors has made upgrading the water infrastructure of the nation's cities and towns a top priority.
Providing good water and sewer doesn't get you elected, but not providing it gets you fired immediately.
And I gather that some of these water and sewer pipes beneath our streets were built to last, 50, 75 years, and some of them are even older than that. Do you fear that we're pushing up against those expiration dates?
Well, there's no question, and we are incredibly unfunded in terms of the gap of what we need and where we're at today. Mayor Rybak in Minneapolis is a very dear friend, and of course, we all watch with horror the collapse of the bridge. That's above ground. If folks really understood what's going on beneath the ground, we're in far worse straits throughout the country.
Explain that.
Our infrastructure is aging. There has been no major new investment in water and sewer infrastructure in decades and decades. And we know that the gap is in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So throughout America, and particularly if you're on the East Coast or any of the older cities, nobody knows exactly what's going on underground. So water systems collapse, sewer systems collapse, they become intertwined, substantial health hazards.
I live in New York City, and some of those pipes and sewage systems are really old.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And then what we've done through the Water Council is to also not just look at the basic service aspect of water and sewer, but also from the perspective of adaptation to climate change, because we know if we do everything exactly right, there still will be adverse impacts from climate change. So that the wetter areas need to be prepared for more rain. That may involve levee systems. It's certainly anyone that looked in what happened after Katrina to the water and sewer systems backfilled with sand knows that those have to be addressed as well. And then the drier areas have to look at their conservation programs to produce that water supply and again, adapt to the realities of climate change, some of which, you know, are inescapable, unavoidable.
And what impact does these sewage overflows and spills have on our life?
Well, obviously, when you have a sewer overflow, it's a public, direct public safety hazard. And of course, we know that historically, the incidence of serious disease dropped overnight when we took our sewers underground as opposed to above ground. It is just basic municipal service, basic public safety and health. So all these things are there, and I don't know what it will take for Congress to wake up, for the nation to wake up to the frightening deterioration of our water and sewer infrastructure in this country.
If we ignore this issue, do you think that we face a future where it may be more difficult to have access to clean water?
Well, there's no question that, as someone said not long ago, you fix the roof when it's not raining. And that's part of what we're trying to do as mayors is to sound the call, to say, look, we need to focus public attention, public dollar, frankly, on this problem, because it's not going to go away. It's going to get worse and worse and worse.
Martin Chavez is mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's also co-chair of the Mayor's Water Council for the United States Conference of Mayors. Thank you so much for coming on our program.
Thank you.
The question of well-maintained municipal waterworks has been a clarion call for environmentalists who have been taking aim at the bottled water industry. The critics say the tap is a precious public resource and people are taking it for granted. The argument has fueled a campaign to get people to stop buying bottled water. But the Chicago Tribune's Red Eye reporter, Alexia Elejalde Ruiz, has been looking into the matter and has learned that it's not so easy to find an alternative.
The environmental push to wean Americans off bottled water has been accompanied by an equally impassioned health prerogative to get Americans to drink more water. What's a thirsty, planet-loving person to do? There are alternatives to the single-serving plastic water bottles that have been demonized recently as landfill-clogging, oil-wasting enemies to the environment. Get a reusable bottle. Drink from glass. There are even biodegradable bottles made from corn. But even seemingly green-friendly options have their drawbacks. Take reusable plastic bottles. They get an A from an environmental standpoint because you can use them over and over again instead of launching them into the waste stream after a single use. But there are health concerns. That number 7 on the bottom of those reusable bottles indicates it's made of polycarbonates, also used in baby bottles and water coolers. Polycarbonates contain a controversial chemical called bisphenol A, which at high enough levels could increase the risk of cancer, birth defects, or reproductive problems. The plastics industry insists those levels are never reached. After some digging into the research, scientists remain unresolved on this question. So why not reuse that old Ice Mountain or Dasani bottle that's been sitting on your desk since yesterday or even last week? It turns out unless you're a stickler about cleaning it after every use, bacteria accumulates. You can't necessarily see or smell the microbes, but health officials say they can make you sick. Makers of those PET bottles insist there is a way to reuse their products safely. Wash with hot, soapy water. Dry thoroughly. But not so fast. Some environmentalists say a chemical called antimony found in PET plastic can leach over time into the water and cause nausea, dizziness, and depression. Research on the question? Not conclusive. The favored choice among environmental groups is the stainless steel water bottle. Doesn't leach chemicals, and it lasts. It does take more energy to produce it, and you've got to pay for it at about $20 a piece. Better not lose it. So why don't we just go back to glass? Made of sand, limestone, and soda ash, one scientist told me glass is the gold standard and what everyone hopes their container will be like. nothing can leach from it, and it can be recycled over and over again, while plastic bottles are typically recycled only once into carpet fiber, for example, which in turn is not recyclable. Alas, we come full circle. Manufacturers started using plastic in the first place because it's so much lighter, which means transporting plastic bottles around the world takes a lot less fuel. For Justice Talking, I'm Alexia Elejalde Ruiz.
America's Water Wars. How should a vital resource be shared? Tell us what you think at justicetalking.org. You can post on our message boards, learn more about our guests, and sign up for our free podcast. And check out our blog, where many of the nation's leading commentators give their views on law and American life. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll tune in next week. I'm Margo Adler. Justice Talking is produced by Ingrid Lakey, Cara McGurk, Jean Barron, Viet Le, Julie Meshack, and Judy Jarvis. Gary Gaiman is our webmaster. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Engineering by Audio Post Philadelphia. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the Annenberg Public Policy Center or National Public Radio. This is NPR's Justice Talking.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From the Kauffman Foundation, featuring the book Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism, and the Economics of Growth and Prosperity at kauffman.org. And from the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support on the web at kresge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.